Kenzo Shibata, welcome back to the show, returningest champion. How are you today?
Doing all right, Dan. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming back. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on this week, and I do want to say happy National Teachers Appreciation Week, and to show her appreciation to you, Janice Jackson, the CPS CEO, just stepped down, and we're going to talk about what that means and for Chicago. We're going to talk about what that means for you, because you get her job now. There's no arguing. Everyone has to sit back and relax because Kenzo's in charge now. Okay, so why does CPS have a CEO? Like, what the fuck is that all? Why is there a CEO? It sounds fucked up, right? It's not a business. They're not making money.
The long and short of it, the reason why that person is designated as a CEO is that the Chicago Board of Education, working along with Mayor Richard Daley at the time, and the Republican caucus of the state legislature, came together and they changed basically like the political landscape for us in 1995 by introducing something called the Amendatory Act, which vastly limited what we could bargain over. So it basically said that we could only strike as a union, as a teachers union, over wages and benefits, which means that like we couldn't strike over things like class sizes or safe facilities or, you know, additional funding for students who are homeless, all things that we've later fought for and won. But through very strategic campaigning alongside a strike. But we could never like legally say we're striking over class sizes. So it had to be like a pressure campaign using the force of a strike in, you know, a few times in the last few years. And so one of the provisions also was that we would no longer have a superintendent presiding over schools. A superintendent by law has to have teaching administration credential, a Type 75 certificate. So by designating this person as CEO, Daley was able to appoint a person named Paul Vallis, who had zero teaching experience and zero teaching credentials, who decimated the school system, gutted all of the education to career programming that kept a lot of kids in school who were not college bound, privatized large swaths of the school, fired hundreds at that point black educators from, you know, schools with mainly black students. So by having the latitude to hire a headhunter, or not a headhunter, but a cleaner, like a political cleaner, someone who can go in and gut out a department, he didn't have to hire anyone who actually had some empathy for the students. So that's why, and to this day, we've had a CEO, Janice Jackson, who just stepped down. She happened to actually be an educator. She taught for a few years, and she was a principal and worked for central office. But she also, I think, demonstrated how, even if the bottom line is our leadership should come from the education world, they also have to have the morals and the ethics of, you know, the communities. And Janice Jackson did not.
She did not have the morals and the ethics of the community. So let's go ahead and do a little bullet point list. Like, what can we point at along the way? How has she failed our communities? Obviously, we've had COVID. It seems like there's been an arbitrary rush to get students back to school. Was she part of that? Was she part of the opposition?
No, she was part of that.
Well, fuck her then. Sorry.
And I think that, like, it's important, though, to note that it doesn't matter. The structure is exactly the same, and we have an awful mayor. Those are the two things working against us. We have a mayor who has the power to appoint the entire school board, who then hires the super or the CEO. So the CEO is essentially handpicked by the mayor of Chicago. And we currently have a mayor who has used all of her political capital against the teachers union and the progressive movement in this city. So Janice Jackson is going to be removed and replaced with Janice Jackson 7.0. And I want to talk a little about history here, because this is important that no matter who the CEO is, they always have just taken on the line of Chicago's ruling class, which is expressed through this group called the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago. And these are like the Billionaire Boys Club, basically, of Chicago. And they have an agenda for the schools, and they have a tremendous amount of power over the decisions that are made. Sometimes, like, they'll literally, like, people will leave, you know, their organization to work for the Chicago Public Schools to privatize things more quickly. And when I first started teaching, Arne Duncan was the CEO of the schools. And Arne Duncan was a person who grew up in a very influential family and was literally basketball buddies with Barack Obama before either of the men had a big name for themselves. So they were part of an inner circle. And Arne Duncan took his cues directly from the Daley administration, which led to the wide-scale closing of schools. The closing of schools and reopening them as non-union schools. Essentially, the goal was to break the back of the Chicago Teachers Union and, you know, the Teachers Union movement in general through privatization. And so, you know, it was no mistake that when Arne Duncan, when Barack Obama, when he attained higher office, he brought Arne Duncan with him and brought all of his privatization with him. And so now Arne Duncan was really in the vanguard of where all of these atrocious education reforms were coming from. Charter schools, closings, scripted curriculum, things like that.
Turnarounds.
And then so he always had like this political ally in a very high place. And so then he was replaced by a person named Ron Huberman, who was literally like a security analyst, like not money securities, but like he was, I believe, in the IDF in Israel. And but he was just another guy that was shifted around different departments. And if Daley wanted someone to go here and then like privatize stuff and make deals with, you know, literal security firms, you know, that was what happened. And then he got to quietly leave after closing a bunch of schools. So none of these people that run the schools, quote unquote, run the schools, have to stick around to see the folly of all of their policies. And so they're put in a position to take on the mayor's agenda, and then they get to like find some sort of easier cush, better paying job, much less stressful job somewhere else. And you know, basically leave in its wake a decimated system that the mayor then can recreate in their own image.
All right, Kenzo. So no matter the CEO,
yeah,
they're beholden to sort of like Chicago's ruling class. You mentioned this civic committee. What is their name? I was trying to catch that too.
Civic Committee of the Commercial Club.
Okay. Yeah.
They're highly influential. You were talking earlier about the AUSL organization.
Yes.
AUSL basically formed out of there.
Huh.
And really horrendous stuff happened. Like one of their folks got a job on staff with CPS. There's a residency requirement for all CPS staff, all City of Chicago employees. We have to live in the city limits. This person got an exception so he could live in the North Shore suburbs and privatized a bunch of schools here. So like he was absolutely positively unaccountable. And this is like the idea there is that these are people in very high positions and they want to remake the school system so, you know, it's less of a tax burden on them and there's less democratic control from the communities.
I love how you're talking about this. I pulled up the website here. It looks great, you know, it's, but it's insidious. It's
you look at any deep, of these websites from NGOs, and if what you're reading, if your eyes start to wander and you're like, you know, falling asleep because it just looks like copy and paste, you know, copy pasta from an NGO, it means they're probably doing something very bad behind the scenes. If it's like, where's the mission statement? You know, it's like, oh, we want better schools for our children. Of course. You know, we want to close the achievement gap. Sounds great. But then there's no fine print explaining how to get there. And that's when, you know, the backroom deals. That's what greases that.
Yeah. You don't want to see what makes it happen. That was a fascinating video, by the way. You showed that with me today. How does Arne Duncan end up video after being caught doing backroom deals that are illegal? How does he go on to be Obama's Secretary of Education? How does that fucking work? How do I wrap my head around that?
I'm not even facetious when I'm saying this. This is actually the name of a chapter in Ben Burgess's new book.
Yeah.
Cancel culture isn't real. That's why. That Arne Duncan in that moment, first of all, the papers and the local news did not pick up on that clip. These are very high powered people, and they were able to make sure that clip stayed just on YouTube. And so, like, folks who were political nerds like me knew about that. That was just common knowledge. Yeah. And you don't even need that video because you know this shit happens. And you know how it works, but like it never got like any kind of mainstream attention at the time, except for those of us who were committed to organizing against that stuff. And so this never really stuck to his image. And he was able to go into the White House with a pretty squeaky clean image.
No. Bad, Kenzo. Make it stop, Kenzo. So now that you're going to be CPS CEO, how are you going to change things and make it better?
Well, that's the thing. I would never be a CPS CEO under this mayor. In fact, I would not want to do that job until the entire system has been fixed, restructured, where there isn't a CEO, where there's a superintendent that's hired by a elected school board. Interesting thing to say about the elected school board is that that was something that our mayor, Lori Lightfoot, campaigned on supporting. It's not something she could do by fiat. She has to, or the state legislature makes that call. But she's used basically all of her clout downstate in Springfield at our Capitol to make sure that bill doesn't get passed. And when that bill gets passed, here's the thing, like it's not something that we can like, it's not something that's going to change the system overnight. So she's not blocking this bill, I think, because she's worried that she's going to have to deal with an elected school board. It's going to take a few years to implement this. I think that she is basically serving, you know, Chicago's ruling class here to make sure that if she's not mayor, if she doesn't make another term, you know, we still don't have this elected school board. They're very intent on us not being able to do that. And my theory behind that is they've seen the political power that the Chicago Teachers Union has built over the past 10 years. And we have political partners, elected official partners. You know, we could build strong machine to run strong pro public education candidates, and they just don't want to change the political landscape here that much. So that is a hot button issue. Under this mayor, you know, it's going to be really hard to keep pushing for this.
So the Chicago Teachers Union has demonstrated its strength through organizing and what you're saying, Kenzo, is because of you, we won't get an elected school board. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kenzo. What an asshole. Thanks for I'm completely being ridiculous and sarcastic, facetious, I believe is the word. Obviously, what do we do? We just keep organizing. We keep we keep showing people the necessity of an elected school board. We keep showing people that because we don't have an elected school board, we get a CEO, and it's all connected here, all the way up to the mayor, who promised that they would relieve us of this problem, and if they've done nothing but make it so that it won't pass, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so where do we go from here? We got to get Mayor Lori Lightfoot to resign. Otherwise, when's the end of her? When do we vote again?
2023.
Oh, fuck, 2 more fucking years with this?
Yeah. So I don't think we're going to get her to resign.
No, she's too just shameless.
We've already seen how battle tested she is. Like, you know, as hard as the strike was on us, it's still hard, even though she, you know, gets to watch us go on strike from her ivory tower. It's still very stressful. She's been through a strike. She's been through a couple near strikes. She's been through a couple big, really big scandals. I don't think she's going to resign on her own will, and I don't think we'll be able to recall her. So the idea is just, I think, for the next couple of years, resist and build power in the wards to elect more socialist aldermen.
And speaking of which, what did those socialist aldermen do in the past week? They just made a little socialist caucus or something like that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, they basically went public. We've had, you know, to brag, it's 10% of Chicago's city council are members of the DSA, and they're out socialists. And they recently announced that they're considering themselves an official caucus in city council, which is, it's a very bold move, I think, especially considering there's 5 of them.
Yeah.
It's saying that we are going to expand, and I think they are. We are going to expand them in the next cycle. And that, you know, it was just a big, bold move to say, like, we are an official caucus. That means that when there are city council meetings, you know, some of them might be in the, some of them are in the Latinx caucus. Some of them are in the LGBTQ caucus. You know, those caucuses will break out and have sidebars during meetings to say, like, you know, talk about their constituents. And that means that, like, on these bills, the socialists will break off and have these discussions about, you know, how should they as socialists approach these policy issues. And what's interesting too about our 5 socialist aldermen is that they don't have, you know, they work in lockstep in city council, but as individuals, there's a diversity of you know, socialist thought there. Mm-hmm. And watching them grow and blossom as an official organ of DSA, that's just beautiful. That's what we need to be replicating, I think.
So DSA will be supporting more candidates for aldermen in the future. And
have to.
And what do you think about mayor? Do one of the existing alder people that are DSA folks, is there any pathway for any DSA person becoming mayor or DSA supporting?
Yeah. Knowing our local DSA's capacity, which has swelled during the pandemic. The problem, though, is that, you know, our numbers have swelled, but we have a lot of folks that haven't worked campaigns before, or at least not in a traditional sense, because everything has been mainly digital as far as canvassing and things like that. So we're going to have to kind of train our folks and, like, have a solid means of our hashing out political differences around electoral issues, because, you know, we're a new organization, basically, because we got new members, new folks in leadership. So we're going to have to, like, at that point, evaluate our capacity. I don't think we're anywhere near running our own mayor for candidate, for our own candidate for mayor. I think that our power right now is identifying the neighborhoods, the wards where there's a strong, you know, working class movement, not necessarily socialist movement, where we could find candidates that are DSA members to support. I think Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez is a great example of that. You know, she was already well known in her community, already organizing, an educator in the community, and a DSA member and an open socialist who's been doing organizing work her entire life. So she was a no-brainer when it came time to like endorsing her. We need to find more people like her and groom people into like taking on more leadership like that. So I'm confident that we can pick up some seats in city council with we have us having this like dying old political machine that doesn't really exist anymore. It allows us for a lot of opportunities if we are strategic in our organizing and having proper density in places where we need. When I say density, I mean like DSA, not just members, but volunteers.
Okay. So we got work to do. We need to push for elected school council. We got just groundwork to do to even run a mayoral candidate. Well, what do you think? What happens next? We're just going to get another CPS CEO. We're just going to expect them to toe the company line, as it were, and just be the handmaiden or the whatever or of Lori Lightfoot and her handpicked board. That's the idea here.
Just looking at the state of the world and the state of how Democratic Party officials have been doing things as of late, it's going the person they appoint is going to be how do I put it? It's going to be a woke hire, I think. You know, okay. I'm thinking about that CIA video that came out, the woke CIA video. And, you know, it's been working with our mayor. We have a gay black mayor, female mayor. And throughout the whole entire campaign for safe school reopening, she used those identities constantly. Used those identities against folks that had the same identity as her as well. It's just, you know, it's an insidious way of spinning media. You know, you can't really fool people like that face to face, but like, you know, they can carry a nice narrative in the news about that. And I think they're going to go that route with the next CEO, and whomever that person is, they're going to carry the same fight as the mayor against the union. So, you know, I just think we have zero control over who that person's going to be. When they announce who that person is going to be, there's often a knee-jerk reaction for some folks to say, well, we got to like cancel this person. We got to like expose them of all of, you know, here's all their dirty deeds. Here's all their conflicts of interest. And no one gives a shit. The average person is not a political nerd who really cares about the very specifics of who the CEO is going to be. So, you know, we just have to like stay steadfast in what we believe in and what our fight is and what we're fighting for. The elected school board, I think, is our North Star. And, you know, we just have to keep fighting for that. And then eventually we won't have to worry about who the mayor appoints because the mayor won't be appointing anybody.
So my guess is they'll appoint someone who's trans and we won't be able to say shit, dude. They're gonna make us seem like an asshole, no matter what. And love to our trans comrades, of course. All right, so we're gonna push for the elected school board. Hopefully it resolves that issue eventually. Okay, that logic checks out. Makes sense, Kenzo. Well, I'm just sort of like wondering, what about Janice Jackson? Where does she go from here? What is she angling for?
Well, she just announced that she's a fellow at some hoity-toity education NGO, which that's like, she basically gets to retire at 35 or however old she is. Like that's a fake email job with fancy lunches. basically.
Sounds pretty nice.
It's beautiful. You have to sell your soul to get there, but the work is beautiful. Show up to a couple charter school board meetings here and there where they have catered lunches. I've seen that with my own two eyes. Noble Street schools catered lunches for their CEOs or for their board of directors. And that's the life that she's going to live now for ramming through a very reckless and dangerous reopening plan, fighting the union every inch of the way when we're trying to advocate for our students and carrying water for the mayor.
Yeah. Do we need, hold on, Kento. We've covered a lot of ground here and I just want to make sure we've exhausted this topic. Now, the CTU bargaining rights have been restored. Did we exhaust that topic specifically? What does that mean? What is the CTU thinking about moving forward with this new reality? What can we be hopeful for?
Well, we've always had to be very careful on our contract campaigns that, like, even if someone were to, like, hold up a picket sign saying, I am on strike for class sizes, someone could take a picture of that, take that to the labor board and say that we are committing an unfair labor practice, that we're violating labor law because we can only strike over wages and benefits. So it took very precision training of our members during the 2012 strike to tell them that you can have posters and tweets that say, like, I support small class sizes, I support air conditioning in buildings, I support, you know, anything that we were bargaining for, but they couldn't say, I'm on strike for this. Thankfully, we had such great discipline in that strike that no one broke that guidance.
No one told me that. I'm surprised I didn't fuck that up for everyone.
Well, I worked at the teachers union's communications department at the time. So, like, every tweet that I, not every tweet, but, like, I had to go through a training from the lawyers about, like, what's safe to tweet, what's not. Yeah. And then anytime I thought something might cross a line, I would, like, email them before sending it. And thankfully, they had staffers that were, like, just as online as I was. I mean, they loved my Twitter before we started working together. Same. Like, same. You know, if I sent them an email, they got back to me right away.
That's awesome. I'm sorry. And I feel like I interrupted you there, but, so now we can, I'm not a teacher anymore, Kenzo. Now you can, now teachers can strike for those things. They can be like, I'm on strike for this. They can be a little bit, more explicit. And
what that means in negotiations is that if we hit, cause at one of the things that was very, masterful about our leaders who are on the negotiating table is that because only wages and benefits are mandatory subjects of bargaining, we'd find a way to, like, make sure that we would not settle on wages and benefits until the very end. That way we could stay on strike as long as we needed to. So we would kind of negotiate that swiftly, push that to a side, and then fight over all these other things. But then officially we wouldn't be on strike except for those wages and benefits. This puts everything on the table now. So if we hit a standstill about class size, we could go on strike over that. And what that means too is that when we're organizing for support in our communities, parents, students, and others, when we tell them, like, we're going to go on strike to make sure your kids have, you know, reasonable class sizes, they're going to support us, I think, for much longer than if it's about wages and benefits.
Right. Because they corner you in, they put you in a corner. They put baby in a corner and they say, this is all you can do. And, and that's all you can do. And so you're like, okay, well, I guess I'll do a strike over wages. And then everyone in the area is like, oh, look at them. All they care about is themselves. All these teachers, they're so greedy. And obviously teachers need to be fucking knocked down a peg in society, I guess. I don't know what the fuck the deal is, but, So you all got cornered with that. What did you say? That was back in the 90s? Or when was that? With which daily made that agreement that limited bargaining?
That was 95. That was
fuck, dude?
Daily 2.
Yeah. Richard. Mm-hmm. And then he left relatively abruptly. We all were shaking our heads. And by the time we came to, Rahm Emanuel was mayor.
My theory, couple theories about why Daley left. One of them, I think, you know, the basic overarching idea was that the ruling class did not see him as being as powerful as he once was. This was a time when the Chicago machine was really on its last legs, and it was becoming replaced with a neoliberal machine, where the power did not come from doling out jobs within the wards, but the power actually came from like DC, New York, like, you know, where finance happens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, like, it happens in our backyard too. And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second there.
Yeah, Daley and then Rahm. And
yeah. Daley was not working fast enough. Mm. And the Civic Committee, the Commercial Club, which is the loudspeaker for these business interests, they wanted to close a huge swath of schools. And Daley couldn't deliver that. He was able to deliver maybe a dozen school closings a year. And another thing I think was...
And Rahm could, so they got him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think losing the Olympics, too. Was a huge...
We were trying to get the Olympics.
Because the Olympics wasn't just the Olympics. The Olympics were a plan that would have raised public housing, mental health clinic, basically everything that Rahm Emanuel later went on to close on his own. Our Olympics plan was a way of just, you know, decimating all of these public services and public housing and replacing it with infrastructure like stadiums and all sorts of stuff to make Chicago even more of an attraction.
And instead they spent all that money in Wrigleyville.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, the plan is happening. It just didn't.
Wow.
The Olympics were supposed to happen in one fell swoop. Like, wherever you go,
this city's making sense.
Yeah. So, like, that it was like a plan. And then there was so much opposition in the neighborhoods. And I think part of it was Daley has this boss mindset. You know, he was raised by his dad, who literally was the boss of the city. Mm. And he's like, no, he wanted to get the Olympics. And the community organizations were willing to compromise on what's called a community benefits agreement. So that would be a way of making the city accountable for all the people that would lose housing and services. And so, like, all the new construction should include new mental health clinics, new all of those services. And Daley wouldn't budge on that either. Mm. So I think he... he thought he had more power than he did. Okay. And there was a lot of trust. You know, he was flying out to Geneva, Switzerland to talk to the International Olympics Committee pretty regularly. Wow. Side note, this is a really cool fact. My friend Ramsen Cannon, who, you know, still an organizer in Chicago, and Bob Quellos, who is the husband of Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez, they headed up this effort called No Game Chicago, which was the opposition to the Olympics. And that became this huge coalition, because they go to a meeting and someone would come over and say, like, I lost my train of thought again. Sorry. Long day.
All good, buddy. Rosana Rodriguez is
So
opposition.
That also, I think, goes to show you the kind of roots that Rosana already had in the community.
It
was a very successful campaign, and like, some of the coolest things that happened is Bob and Martin Macias, another very young activist. I think Martin was like 19 at the time. They also flew to Geneva, Switzerland to talk to the IOC. And so this was like a real fucking bird dogging campaign, bird dogging one of the most powerful mayors in the country at that time. And Daley had to take a big L on it. And then, you know, we didn't get the Olympics. And I think that reason and like his inability to just very quickly privatize the city, they got him out. And Rahm Emanuel, who like they were hinting for years, people in interviews would say, would you ever come back to run for mayor of Chicago? And he says, that's my dream. Like he always said that he wanted to do that. And I think it was just a perfect opportunity because he was just a vicious, cold-blooded political operator. And that's what they wanted to have for a few years to just, and I keep using the word decimate, but that's just what they've done to the city services.
All right. Well, we're 2 years out from another election. You don't think we're going to run a candidate for then? We're going to focus then, I guess, at even more hyper local level, aldermen, get more of them in there. We're up to five out of 50. 10% you mentioned. Okay, so there's 50. Okay, I just
the thing about
that.
Mayor though is the a finer point that I would want to put on that is I don't think DSA has the political power right now to run a candidate, but what would be optimal is that we could get a coalition together to back a candidate that would be for the people. And like that's only happened once in our city's history, which was Harold Washington. Mm. But it's happened. And if the man didn't die in office, who knows how long he would have been in office. He was reelected once after a very nasty, campaign for his first time in office that in some ways united parts of the city, but very much divided also parts of the city. And I'm not saying it in a bad way. I'm saying that is like, he was the right candidate and these were divisions that were existing and the other side of the division started building power, a very good thing. And I actually have faith that we can do this again. Mm-hmm. What we have in Chicago right now with, when we talk about the United Working Families Party, we talk about the DSA, Asada's Daughters, Black Youth Project. We have a much bigger coalition of leftists in Chicago now than we did then. And people that have political experience now in that coalition. We just need to figure out how to tie ourselves together to make ourselves accountable to that coalition and have, the hardest part and then find a candidate that will like rightly take the medal of, what we're looking to do.
All right, Kenzo, what else is left? What do we need to cover here, buddy? Yeah. I think we've been we've exhausted most things. Everything I was wondering about. And I don't want to wrap things up necessarily, but just wondering if there's anything else on your mind in terms of everything that we're chatting about today.
Excuse me. We did skip over a big chunk of history too, because because like I said, though, is that like we've had these carbon copy CEOs. So like we've had about 8 in the past 15 or so years. After Huberman, who I mentioned earlier, who was like a security guy, also a cop at one point. We had an interim guy named Terry Mazzani, who was a very kind, sweet man who was not around long enough to make any important decisions. We got the list there.
I was trying to, Barbara Bird Bennett. She's my favorite.
Then after that was Jean-Claude Bazard.
Jean-Claude, yeah.
He was a mess. He like was very much just a spokesperson for the ruling class of the Chicago Public Schools.
Yeah. It was clear it was just sort of like a stepping stone to whoever was going to come next. They didn't seem like they were staying along for too long.
The anecdote I love about him is that when we were negotiating the 2012 contract, he was not allowed in the room during negotiations. He was like slowly watching himself get pushed out of his job. He was fired shortly after that strike. That happens pretty quickly, is that they either leave or get fired. And one day during negotiations, he showed up with a box of donuts, I think trying to act like he was going to be invited in. And the chief negotiator for the Board of Ed, Ed Franzik, he's just, a lawyer. He told Jean-Claude to go home and took the donuts.
Took the donuts and sent him home?
So took him to thank you and to take it from here, basically. it was very clear if you were behind the scenes that Jean-Claude Brizard was a dead man walking throughout the entire strike campaign. He was going to be thrown under the bus, and that's what happened.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we've had a couple people since. I don't even know any of them. Yeah.
Forrest Claypool, who was another guy that was passed around from department to department to privatize things and fire people. I'm sorry. I'm skipping around. After that was Barbara Bird Bennett, who is, right, I believe, still in prison. She was a part of the fire sale of the Detroit public school system. She, helped privatize those schools while they were in crisis. And she was also hopping from city to city. Every city she lived in and worked in, she was also kind of doing things on the side as well, with consultants and things like that. She was a very wealthy person until she got caught. And she was also a person that was thrown under the bus after the school closings. So she was the fall guy for that.
Yeah. And then Jean-Claude Brizard, right?
No, Jean-Claude was before her.
Oh.
Okay. Jesse Ruiz was in there for a minute. He's like he was a do nothing. I think he was an interim, to be honest.
Yeah.
Forrest Claypool was another guy that was passed around from department to department. And he was actually my instructor at Northwestern for one of my public policy classes.
Yeah.
And actually,
I'm so sorry.
He could not teach. And I'm not saying that just to be mean. He would have a guest speaker for every one of our classes. We met once a week for 2.5 hours. And he would assign us a chapter to read, have a speaker speak for about 2 hours, summarize the chapter for 20 minutes, and then have a little chit chat for 10 minutes.
And then he had the audacity to
give me a B.
Oh my God, dude.
Because I wrote an analysis about how privatization does not work in public services, which, the people have their own politics, and he was a dick about it. And Janice Jackson.
Yeah, in that picture with Paul Vallis, she's standing in the background. Janice Jackson standing right behind him. It's sort of hard to see there, and then Janice Jackson. Yeah. So we don't know who they're gonna appoint next. What's that process like? They meet, and then the puff of white smoke, and we know, right? Oh.
Gonna talk shit and what we saw there, though, by the way,
I'm so sorry if I can stop you and redo that. I accidentally got cut off right there. So the next question is, Kenzo, how does the next CEO get chosen? Is there a meeting and a puff of white smoke, or is it you don't have to act like that was funny. Yeah, how does that work out?
Puff of hot air is what you see when you get the new CEO.
Yeah, right. It's a windy city.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, a lot of it comes from right there in CPS.
I cut off your joke, Kenzo, which is they do it through a backdoor meeting, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not really a joke, though. It's more like a prediction. Right. I've been in some back rooms, not like that, with people of that high level. And it's one of those situations where you're like, what the fuck's going on? People are talking, kind of cryptically. And it's just like, this is a weird position to be in. And I, you know, if you watch that video, Arnie Duncan's expression on his face, because, you know, he's not in his neighborhood by any means. Like everyone else in that room was from the West Side and, you know, was from that community. The person who busted in with the video camera was an activist from that community. And he's just like this lone white dude, probably thinking, I am way over my head.
He's thinking prison.
I think, you know, there was probably a few skid marks in Arnie Duncan's drawers after that video was shot.
Again, I mentioned this earlier. You dropped that link when we were watching in my stream live earlier, and I'd seen that video, but it somehow makes a lot more fucking sense right now. And it's just, it's scary. It's very frightening.
The mainstream media didn't pick it up and like look into it. That would have been a great thing to look into.
Like, who the fuck is, like, where's Marianne Ahern when you need her? She's like the best of like local journalists right now, and for whatever that's worth. I should say maybe big box local journalists. We do have the Block Club Chicago. I enjoy their reporting. Well, Kenzo, I don't know. What else? Should we wrap that up? Should we wrap that thing up?
Yeah, I think we said it all.
I think we've done said it all. You are our returningest champion. You're a friend of mine. You're a mentor. I enjoy our chats. Looking forforward to next time. You helped me to catch up with the politics in Chicago, and obviously you give us a very unique look. And I'm fortunate, and I'm honored that we get to have these chats. So thank you, Kenzo.
Appreciate you, buddy. Thanks so much, Dan.
All right. Peace and solidarity. We'll see you next time.
Take care.
All right. Whoops. Oh, every single time. That was Kenzo Shibata on my channel. I, Dan Simpson. Hey, thanks for watching. I hope you're enjoying everything. Hey, listener, you just heard an episode of Leftist and Chill, the show you never knew you didn't need but still can't live without, the podcast version. Content like this is only made with the support of listeners like yourself. Please support at patreon.com/idansimpson today.